Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Your Bible questions for Jimmy Akin this hour. Any Bible question from anybody is welcome. Please do not feel like, oh, I'm not a Catholic. They don't want to take my... Yeah, we do. Or I don't know that much about the Bible. Yeah, we do. We want to take your question. If you got a Bible question. I just enjoy the conversations that happen when people ask Jimmy Akin Bible questions. So call 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is... What? Oh, you were going to say?
Well, in terms of enjoying conversations when we talk about the Bible, I mean, we get into some unexpected territory. I mean, last hour, we were talking about Greek medicine and the Egyptian language and archaeology and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, there's some that when I see them there, I go, oh, I can't wait to hear what Jimmy has to say about this one. And that I had to say that Egyptian one I was looking forward to because you know your Bible, but you also know a lot about Egyptian history. At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, well, I try to study all of the cultures that are connected with biblical culture. So, I try to study the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians and the Hittites and everybody I can that's connected with and that might shed light on the Bible.
Right. Yeah. For a lot of their history, Israel is kind of squished between the Hittites and the Egyptians, huh? It's like if those two wanted to fight, they had to come fight in Israel, basically.
Yeah, and the Hittites are people who are based in Turkey, in modern Turkey, and the Egyptians are obviously based in Egypt, and they've got the Mediterranean Sea between them, and the Egyptians were terrible sailors. They were really spoiled by the Nile River. Because it's very calm. They can just sail up or down the Nile River, but they did not want to cross the Mediterranean. And it's also hard to bring a big invading army across the sea in ancient times. So what they would do, because they were traditional enemies, is they would go around the Mediterranean Sea, which would take them right through the Holy Land. Yeah. And so, Israel was caught between the Egyptians and the Hittites. Fortunately, at certain points in time, there was some rapprochement between the Egyptians and the Hittites. In fact, during the reign of Ramesses II, Ramesses, as he was getting older, decided to make a treaty with the Hittites, and it was actually carved on a silver plate. And Ramesses was so proud of his peace treaty with the Hittites, where we're going to be friends now, that he had it copied onto multiple temples. So we have these different copies of his treaty with the Hittites, and we also have other pieces of information from his reign where he a couple of times married Hittite princesses, you know, to strengthen diplomatic ties with the Hittites. And so when they send a princess, you know, they're going to send an escort with her, a military escort to keep her safe because it's not safe to travel. And so when the princess, this is the second of the two princesses, when she arrives, she's got this big, you know, train of people. She's got this whole caravan escorting her, including her military bodyguard. And so they're there for the wedding in Egypt. And one of the things it notes in the records, which was just kind of mind-blowing to the Egyptians, was that at the wedding feast, you had Hittite soldiers and Egyptian soldiers sitting down and eating together. Wow. Without fighting.
Yeah.
And they specifically note that we weren't fighting. We were eating together.
Yeah.
And that was just kind of mind-blowing for them because the Hittites were a traditional enemy. There's also, and this is a little bit before the time of Ramesses, but King Tut lived, King Tut, he died very young and unexpectedly. And there is a significant argument that he may have been murdered. And part of the evidence for that is we've got a letter that was written by King Tut's widow. And she's writing to the king of the Hittites. And she says, "My husband is dead, and I don't want to marry a servant. So please send me one of your sons, and I will marry him and make him king of all Egypt." And the king who got this was gobsmacked. I mean, this is before Ramesses' peace treaty, remember?
Yeah.
And he was just, he's like nothing. He went to his advisors. We have the Hittite records of this from his son. Saying, you know, my father was just amazed and went around to his advisors saying, nothing like this has ever happened to me before. What do you think? Is this a real offer or is this some kind of a trap or what's going on here? In the end, he decides, his name was Shupi-Uliuma. So King Shupi-Uliuma decides after he sends ambassadors to investigate, is this a real offer? And the queen writes back and says, of course, this is a real offer. I'm desperate to get a new husband, not from here. Why would I be trying to trick you? I just want I want a new husband and I'll make him king of Egypt. This is a good offer. Please say yes. And so he said yes. And so he picked one of his unmarried sons and he sent him off to Egypt with a military bodyguard like you would expect. And at the border of Egypt, he was murdered.
Oh, come on. After all this?
Almost certainly by on orders of King Tut's successor, who was named Ai. He was his former guardian because King Tut was so young. His regent, Ai, took over the throne, married the queen, became king of Egypt, and had that Hittite prince eliminated.
Well, Shupi Doopy Doopy, what was the guy's name?
Shupi-Uliuma.
Oh, yeah.
Shupi-Uliuma.
He's got to be mad now. This is a bad deal.
Well, he unfortunately didn't live too long because he started a war against the Egyptians after they killed his son, and a plague started in the war. And so it was a pandemic, and the illness, the virus, came back into Hatti land, or you know, where they lived in Turkey, and killed bunches of people, including King Shupi-Uliuma. And so we know about this from a set of prayers that his son wrote, called the Plague Prayers, in which he recounts the events leading up to the plague.
Oh, man. Man, tough way to go out as the Hittite king.
Who thought history was boring?
I know. It's fascinating. It's got some good names in it, too.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Camille in Quebec, Canada, listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are next, Camille. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, my question is when Jesus came in and he was challenged by the Jews about him changing stuff regarding divorce, because Moses allowed them to give their wives a paper or a document and send her. And he told them it's because they were hard-hearted. And you know, later on, obviously, in the Catholic Church, divorce was not allowed. So this is a change from the old Bible. So how do we explain he did change the old Bible, the old Mosaic law?
Actually, he didn't. And this is something that not a lot of people have studied. And I was under the impression for a long time that he did. In these passages, there's two of them where this has gone into. One is in Mark chapter 10, the other is in Matthew 19. And I had been under the impression that he was like announcing a new thing here. But then I wrote a commentary on Mark, and I went back and I studied the passage that is at issue here. It's found in Deuteronomy 24. And I discovered, much to my surprise, Jesus wasn't changing anything. He was actually furthering the line of thought that is right there in Deuteronomy 24. So this was, and I should mention, this was a live issue in rabbinic discussions, and it continued to be for some time, because if you look in Deuteronomy 24, it starts like this. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house. So that's all the first verse. And the rabbis, would look at that and say, okay, so Moses is allowing these guys to do that. He's allowing them to write a bill of divorce and the woman leaves. What grounds is it okay to do that? And so they would zero in on the phrase some indecency in her. And they would debate what that means. Does that mean adultery, or does it just mean he's not happy? One opinion was that even if she burned a dinner, that's enough of a source of displeasure for him to divorce her. And so you had a range of opinions, but they were all centering on this first verse. And when you keep reading, you find that actually this has a different meaning. Now, one of the things to understand about the different about many passages in the Torah, in the instruction that God gave the Israelites in the first five books of the Bible, is that he's not creating laws out of nothing, because the Israelites already had a culture. You know, before the law was given, they had a culture. And so that culture, like any culture, had customs and traditions and laws. And what God is really doing is regulating things that were already happening. So it's not like in the law of sacrifice, it's not like God's telling them how to do sacrifices for the first time. They've already been sacrificing to God. Now God is giving them instructions to regulate the practice of sacrifice. And it's the same thing here. People have already been divorcing. Now God is giving a regulation to control the phenomenon of divorce. It's not like he's introducing the concept here for the first time. He's regulating an existing practice. So when we keep that in mind and we take a look at the whole passage, we find it says this: when a man takes a wife and marries her, so that's the first thing that happens, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency with her, and now we get a whole bunch of series. So the first thing is he marries her, then he gets unhappy with her, and now we've got a whole bunch of conditions that need to be jointly met before we get to the conclusion. And he writes a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house. So that's assuming, we're assuming he's done this. God isn't commenting on, is this a good or bad thing? This passage is assuming a man has already done this because people were already divorcing. And if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter husband dislikes her and writes her a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, so now the same thing has happened. Or if the latter husband dies, who took her to be his wife, then, so we're presupposed all that other stuff has happened. Now we get to the money part. Then her former husband, husband number one, who sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. So that's the law that God is introducing to regulate what happens in divorce. He is, if a guy divorces a wife and she marries somebody else, he cannot take her back. That's what God is regulating. Now, why? Why can the original husband not take her back, even if the second husband dies? Why can't the first one take her back? Well, it says that he may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled. So in the act of divorcing her so that she marries another man, the first husband has defiled her. Because it wasn't safe for women to be on their own in that day. They're going to get married again if they at all can. And so that is defiling. So why, if, as everybody knows, death ends marriage, why would it defile a woman for her to be divorced and marry another man? Because she isn't really divorced. She's still married to the first husband. And so if she marries another man, that's adultery, and that is morally defiling. And that's exactly what Jesus says in Mark and in Matthew, that if you divorce your wife and she goes and marries another guy, she's committing adultery. And that's the basis of what's going on in Deuteronomy 24. She's really not divorced at all. She's still married to husband number one, and she's morally defiling herself by marrying someone else and committing adultery, whether she realizes that's what's happening or not. So actually, Jesus isn't changing anything on marriage. He's clarifying what's right there in Deuteronomy 24.
Camille, we're going to have to leave it there because we got to go to a break. We'll be right back with more of your Bible questions for Jimmy Akin right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's your Bible questions for Jimmy. Every single line full, which often happens on these Fridays. I think people really like the Bible, and there's a lot of Bible questions out there. And I think people really like Jimmy Akin. You put those two together, and you get a lot of calls. I'll give you the number. As lines open up, you're welcome to call with your Bible questions, 888-318-7884. Hey, if you want a really good bit of reading for maybe you're putting together your Lenten reading list, this new book, These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes from Rod Bennett, is now out, and it's a beautiful book. You can save 25% right now when you enter the promo code 12. That's the, spell it out, don't put the numeral. Put the promo code 12 in when you check out at shop.catholic.com and get 25% off the brand new book from the really wonderful writer and speaker, Rod Bennett. These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes. 888-318-7884, the number. Michael in Rochester, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. You're next. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I've been rereading Genesis and Exodus, and two events sort of came up that I wanted some of Jimmy's feedback on. The first is the death of Isaac, right, and Jacob's sort of taking over his brother's first place in line, and the fact that he uses deception to do that, and how we think about it, and the second, I'll just put it out there, is reading Exodus, the Israelites are complaining to God at some point about needing, you know, better food, and they want meat, and God gives them the quail in the desert. But at the same time, it seems like they've taken their herds and flocks with them, and they're using them for sacrifice. And that just seemed like an inconsistency to me. So if Jimmy could respond as he'd like to both those topics, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, so regarding Jacob supplanting Esau, there are two relevant incidents that occur. He first obtains Esau's birthright, and this happens because Esau sells it to him. So Esau comes in from having been active outside, and he's starving, and Jacob is cooking some stew, and Esau says, "Give me some of the stew," and he says, "Well, give me your birthright." And Esau says, "Oh, I'm going to die if I don't get something to eat. Give me the stew." And it's like, "Well, I'll give you the stew if you give me your birthright." And Esau agrees to that. And so that Jacob gets by barter. You know, it's a fair exchange. I mean, you could say, you could criticize it in various ways, but there's no deception involved here. We then have the second incident, which occurs as Jacob is preparing to die. As Isaac is preparing to die. And Isaac and his wife, Rebecca, have different favorite children. Isaac's favorite child is Esau, and Rebecca's favorite child is Jacob. And Isaac naturally wants to give his blessing to Esau. And this will, among other things, make Esau his successor as the head of the family, if he gives him his blessing. Because one of the things he's going to say in the blessing is, rule over your brothers. And so, that in effect, he's going to put him in charge of the whole household. And so he's planning on doing that as part of his blessing. And Rebecca realizes that, and so she wants to see her favorite son, Jacob, as the new head of the family. So she convinces Jacob, against his will, to go in and deceive their father, who is almost blind at this point, to deceive him into thinking that he's really Esau, and thus receive the blessing in Esau's place, in effect, stealing the blessing that was intended for Esau. And in ancient Near Eastern society, it was believed that the blessing of a patriarch was like prophetic and very powerful spiritually and so forth. And so, at Rebecca's instigation, Jacob goes ahead and cooperates with this. He's actually scared about it. He's reluctant to do it, but he goes ahead and does it. And so he gets the blessing, making him head of the household. And thus the line of God's promise ends up going through him rather than through Esau. And this is something we see a number of times in Genesis. It is not just in this one passage that a younger brother abnormally inherits the rights of the firstborn. That happens several times in Genesis, and scholars have taken note of that fact. Now, what may explain that? Well, it may be explained by it was a historical memory. The Israelites knew they were the chosen people, and they knew they had certain ancestors, and so even if one of their ancestors was not a firstborn, the line of God's promise, since they're the chosen people, the line of God's promise had to go through those ancestors who were not firstborn. And so in their theological understanding of their own history, they would see the line of God's promise passing through these different individuals down to them, even when the individual was not a firstborn. And they would then have incidents that they would relate that explain, well, why in this case did it happen this way? Now, in terms of the moral character of this act, you know, it is deceptive. And you're going to have, in terms of reading the passage and kind of putting it in a moral context today, it's going to depend on your theory of lying, whether lying is ever permitted or not. And in the Christian era, there have been a large number of theologians in the Catholic tradition who have said lying is never okay for any under any circumstances. And there have been others who've said, well, maybe there are some circumstances where lying is okay, like in order to preserve life. You know, the classic example is you could lie to the Nazis at your door about where Jews are being hidden so that you're saving these Jewish lives. And that's kind of a classic example. Almost nobody in current day times, though, who looks back at this passage would say it was subjectively justifiable for Rebecca and Jacob to do this, because this isn't an instance of lying in order to save people's lives. This is a coup. This is a let's take over the family situation, and let's steal this divine thing, you know, that this line of God's promise. So it's not something that would tend to be looked on favorably from either perspective morally today. But we've got to ask, what did the original biblical author think about this? Well, he might have disapproved and just recorded what happened anyway. You know, you can record, the Bible records all kinds of people doing things they shouldn't. It also records people, God bringing good out of things that people did that they shouldn't. And there's the music, but I'll give you a classic example of exactly that on the other side of the break.
Right back with more of your Bible questions for Jimmy Akin right after this.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. It's a tough one, Jacob and Esau. Jimmy, you're in the midst of addressing the fact that God can make good things come out of it. This was where we got to with your answer about Jacob and Esau.
Yeah. So we do see people in recorded in Scripture doing things that are bad, that we're not expected to approve of, and God bringing good things out of them anyway. When that happens, the people who did the bad stuff often have to pay a price. And we see all three of those elements a little bit later on in Genesis in the Joseph narrative, because Joseph is acting a little too big for his multicolored britches, and his brothers get their noses out of joint and decide to fake his death and sell him into slavery. And so Joseph ends up being sold into slavery. And this is unambiguously bad. His brothers should not have been doing this. The reader is expected to recognize that. And nevertheless, God is working through these events and ends up saving huge numbers of lives during a famine.
Right.
Because he's got Joseph in the right place to become administrator of Egypt under Pharaoh and plan for this upcoming famine so that they've got food when it arrives. And he not only saves tons of people in Egypt, he saves his own family. And this is actually how the Israelites get down to Egypt, is because they go there during the famine in order to get food so they don't die. And when they get down there, there's Joseph. And especially after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers are like, oh, guess what? We may be all killed now, now that our father is out of the way and Joseph could like want to kill us or something. And so they send him a message and say to Joseph, before he died, your father asked us to make sure to ask you to be really nice to us and like not kill us. Yeah, we swear he really asked us
that's
to do that.
The exact words. Yeah. That's exact words what he said.
And Joseph is like, guys, don't worry about it. I mean, you meant it against me for evil when you sold me into slavery, but God meant it for good, and that's the important thing. And so he forgave his brothers and didn't carry out vengeance on them. Well, okay, so what do we see if we back up a few chapters and we're looking at this situation where Jacob inherits the line of promise? Well, okay, did he deceive somebody? Yeah, he deceived his father, but he deceived his father Isaac. Did God work good through that situation? Well, yeah, that's how the birthright and the promise came to Israel as the chosen people. That was part of God's plan. So God worked through this act of deception to bring about his larger plan. Did Jacob pay a price for his act of deception in stealing his father's blessing? Oh, yeah. Oh, very much so. Because right after this, after Jacob has died, Esau is so mad that he is contemplating, so he's mentating on the thought of killing Jacob.
Yeah.
He's telling himself, okay, now that my dad is dead, I'm going to kill my brother. And not only is he mentating about this, he's telling other people. So he's telling other people, he's not only ideating about this, he's telling other people, I'm going to literally kill my brother now. And we know that he was telling other people because they went and told Jacob. And they said, your brother is planning to kill you, and he's openly talking about it. And so Jacob gets sent off to be with other members of the family who live distantly. He's sent off to be with to live with his mother's brother, so his maternal uncle Laban, and he spends years and years and years living with Laban. And eventually, he and Laban are on the outs, and so he takes his wife and wives and his children and everything he's got and pulls up sticks and heads back home to the promised land where he knows that Esau is waiting for him. And he goes through these elaborate preparations to try to appease Esau. He's a rich man by this point, and so he has this really rich gift. Set of gifts, actually, that he sends his household slaves ahead of him as messengers to give to Esau because he's heard Esau and several hundred men are coming to meet you. This is like on The Price is Right. This is the like big gift basket collection of stuff. He sends it ahead saying, this is for Esau. I'm trying to be nice. And he then, when he's getting closer to meeting Esau, Jacob's death, but that's okay. When he gets closer to Esau, he's got these two wives and two concubines and 13 children, and he splits them into two groups. Because as he's sending them on ahead, because his thought is, if Jacob and his several hundred men decide to kill us, then maybe one of the two groups will escape, and at least some of my wives and children will survive this encounter.
Right.
So he's strategically dividing them because he's so afraid that Esau is just going to get his long-delayed vengeance.
Right.
And when they finally meet, Esau has forgiven him and doesn't want to kill him, and they fall on each other's necks weeping, and you have this great moment of reconciliation. But did Isaac pay a price for his deception? Oh, yeah. He spent years living under the prospect of Esau's vengeance. He was afraid Esau was going to kill his wives and children. Yeah. He was driven away from his homeland. He suffered all kinds of costs for that deception. Having said that, the question of what are the ancient biblical authors' attitudes towards lying is an interesting question. We do have some anti-lying statements in the Old Testament, but there's also some evidence pointing the other way. And in fact, I'm going to be appearing on Pat Flynn's video podcast to debate lying in a few weeks, in just a couple weeks, on March 1st.
Philosophy for the People, that one?
I just think of it as Pat Flynn's YouTube channel, but yeah.
Okay, yeah. Oh, cool. Very good.
Yeah.
We'll look
now,
forward to that.
There was a second question, which I'll make real quick. Yes, the Israelites did take their flocks with them on their way out of Egypt. But if you eat your flocks, you lose all of your wealth. And they may have been eating some of the flocks, but they may have realized we're kind of endangering our wealth, our prosperity, when we get to this promised land, we're not going to have any animals. And so they were reluctant to eat the animals, which were their material wealth. It's like you don't want to drain everything in your bank account all at once. And so they asked for additional meat, and they got it. Now, having said that, we have to be aware that the biblical authors are not giving us a videotape recording of what happened. These texts here in the Pentateuch were written quite a bit after the events themselves. And so there is some degree of reconstruction of what happened to present a consistent narrative of what happened. You need to reconstruct certain details. And I would propose that the image that we seem to have of the Israelites are starving as if they don't have any animals is probably not what happened literally if we were there videotaping it, which is what prompted Michael's question. I would propose that there was a memory that God used quail to feed the Israelites, and that helped contribute to their food supply. And then this narrative was a reconstruction around that tradition. But we shouldn't press the detail of like they were literally starving and had no meat at all apart from the quail, because they did have flocks. And as Michael mentioned, they even on occasion used them as sacrifices to God.
Michael, got to leave it there. Thank you very, very much. Let's go to Marsha in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Marsha, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
I'd like to comment on what you said about women's hair coverings, if you don't mind, and then I'd like to hear your response.
Okay.
I have three things about this. The first one is that when I first became a Catholic back in the 1950s as a teenager, I was told that we're required to wear head coverings to Mass because it's a sign of modesty and respect. And then today I belong to a traditional Latin Mass, and the priest requires it also. And he said it's because women are sacred and you veil what is sacred, which I like to hear. And then the other point I wanted to make is that in all of the icons and artwork, most of the artwork of the Blessed Virgin Mary, she always has her head covered. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, so I think that... I think that in terms of the reason that that head coverings were formerly, it didn't have to be a veil specifically, but the reason that head coverings were formerly required was that that's what the 1917 Code of Canon Law said. And it's obviously inspired by earlier traditional customs And ultimately, it also incorporates at the origin of those customs both Jewish practices, because women did tend to wear head coverings in ancient Israel, and also obviously St. Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians. So you have this kind of historical collection of customs that has been passed down, and in the 1917 Code of Canon Law, that was codified as this is a law for women who are attending Mass or attending the liturgy. And the new code does not incorporate that, so women are not legally bound to do that anymore. In terms of what was a theoretical logic behind why the code would have this requirement, I think that, well, the law itself didn't tell us. It didn't say women need to wear head covering at Mass and this is why. So it's really a matter of speculation at that point why this should be a law. And one can give a general answer to that in that, well, this is our custom and it's based on certain things, but the law didn't specify it. And so I would say there's room for different kinds of speculation. And your priest's, you know, speculation that, well, it's because women are sacred and we have a custom of veiling sacred things. Well, that's based on some premises that are true. I mean, some women are sacred, and sometimes we mark the sacredness of something by putting a veil around it or putting a barrier of some kind around it. And so those are true, but men are also sacred. Women are not more sacred than men. So I would say that even though this is a thought that can help illuminate the practice, I would welcome it as a speculation on that basis, I don't think it is the kind of reasoning that would mandate this for all time, because in fact, men are just as sacred as women. We are both sacred in God's sight. And men don't have to be veiled. So I would say that the historical causes of this are different than this particular item of speculation. In terms of why we see the Virgin Mary wearing a veil, well, I think that's because in art, I think it's because this is an artistic tradition. And I think the sources of that tradition are based on a couple of things in all likelihood. One is the fact that during many periods of Christian history, women did wear head coverings, especially in a sacred context, and the Virgin Mary is a sacred person, and so it was natural to depict her that way. Also, in Jewish culture, women frequently wore head coverings, and given what St. Paul said in a first century context in 1 Corinthians, it would be natural to view Mary as the supreme example of modesty, and thus is the supreme example of a woman being veiled. So I think all that's, you know, reasonable. My concern, and you know, I'm great with women. I'm kind of a traditionalist. I love, in more than one sense, actually. And if women want to wear veils, I think that's great. If women don't want to wear veils, that's okay too, though. My concern is not to have people looking down on each other one way or another. Is like, oh, this person's a better Catholic than you are because they do or don't wear a veil. Because this should not be a tribal issue on which Catholics get divided and start looking down on each other. This is an example of different strokes for different folks. If you want to honor God by wearing a veil, great, wonderful. If you want to honor God by not wearing a veil, that's fine too. So that's my primary concern.
Marsha, I got to leave it there because we got to go to a break. More calls coming up. There are a couple lines open. If you've got a Bible question you'd like to ask Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
You remember Rocky Balboa? If somebody said, "Yo, Rocky, man, you the Rock," like, you would have caught the rather cheesy verbal play on words quite easily. And that's exactly what Jesus does. So he uses the word Petra in Greek is feminine. He masculinizes it, Petros, to make it refer to a masculine person.
Uh-huh.
And so it's as if Jesus said, "Yo, Rocky, you the Rock."
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guests. We're talking about the Bible. If you've got a Bible question, whether you know a lot or a little about the Bible, whether you are a believer or unbeliever, you're welcome to call. Any question you got's welcome. 888-318-7884. Jimmy wrote a book called The Bible is a Catholic Book, and you can find all kinds of things in there about where how the Bible was assembled and who wrote it and what's in it. And if you got any of those kind of questions, they're welcome. 888-318-7884. Going to Tim in Maryland, watching on YouTube. Tim, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi. I've got a main question and a sort of a side question. The main question is there a penalty for performing incorrectly the sacrament of the Eucharist or communion? Also, the side question is more about like wine versus grape juice. It's caused a huge debate in my family. I'm leaving the Methodist faith over it. The pastor thinks that's sort of like sacrilegious
to use
to drink wine.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. So regarding the first question, is there a penalty for doing the Eucharist wrong? Well, it depends on what kind of penalty you're talking about. In 1 Corinthians, St. Paul is talking to the Corinthians about some abuses that they've been committing in their liturgy, and in particular in connection with the Eucharist. And he says that because of the way they've been abusing the Eucharist, many of you are weak and sick and some sleep, which is a euphemism for death. So he's said that because you're abusing the Eucharist, some of you are weak and sick and some have died. So this would indicate, now, this could be conceptualized either as God is positively inflicting these things as a form of punishment, or simply that God is not giving them grace he otherwise would have given them to help them deal with illnesses and so forth. So God is more like he's not like sending a heart attack on someone, but he is withdrawing a protection that otherwise would have been there if these people had not been abusing the Eucharist. So that deals with the question of divine penalty for abusing the Eucharist. I wasn't sure if you meant a divine penalty or like a penalty in terms of church law, but indeed there are penalties in church law that can be applied for people who abuse the Eucharist in various ways. And if the form of abuse is small enough, then the penalty may need to be applied by a bishop after a trial. But there are some acts of desecration of the Eucharist that are so extreme that they will automatically trigger the penalty of excommunication in canon law. And that form of excommunication, when that happens, because the Eucharist is Jesus himself, when those extreme forms of desecration occur, the excommunication is reserved to the Holy See, meaning that if you've committed one of these acts and been excommunicated as a result, and you repent and want the excommunication lifted, under ordinary circumstances, you're going to need to go to Rome itself or to petition Rome itself to have the excommunication lifted.
Okay.
Now, there was a second question. Mm-hmm.
The main reason I'm leaving this church is a debate over wine and grape juice. And I just, I believe wine is fine. I never had a problem with grape juice, but the pastor compares it to drinking a beer at the altar and taking a toast. You know, it's just, absurd.
Okay, so it seems like his argument would be based on the kind of low regard in which beer is held in our society. So, you know, people think of beer as a very casual thing. And, you know, you have a couple of beers after dinner or something like that, or you have beer at a sporting event, or you go drinking beer with your buddies or something. And so it does have a kind of lower place in the social scheme of things than other beverages. But beer is not wine. And the term, now there's sort of two issues here. Tim, is the question, is alcoholic wine ever permissible? Or is the question, is alcoholic wine permissible, even though it's permissible in other circumstances, is it permissible for communion? Are you looking for an answer to the broader question or the narrower one?
Yeah, the narrow question is, the pastor does not believe wine is ever acceptable at home, at the altar, at communion.
Okay.
They only do communion four times a year, but my wife, you know, she doesn't believe in using wine because the pastor backs her up. And
okay, so a typical way that this gets argued in Protestant circles is that the term for wine, which in Greek is oinos, meant in the Bible, in biblical uses, grape juice. And so it's non-fermented. And it will be argued that sometimes this grape juice is called new wine or sweet wine. And that is clearly not the case. Because if you go to Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, you have the apostles speaking in tongues and various people in the crowd, and Peter talks about this, but various people in the crowd say these men are drunk with new wine. So the idea is they're so intoxicated that they're just babbling, they're raving, because they're speaking in languages people don't understand. And there's the text specifically refers to new wine or sweet wine, depending on the translation. And that reveals to us that new wine is not grape juice that's so new it's unfermented, because these people are referring to new wine or sweet wine, your preference for the translation, as something that will intoxicate. So right there in Acts chapter 2, we've got this identified, new wine or sweet wine, depending on the term you prefer, as alcoholic. So the idea that that's non-alcoholic is nonsense. Then if you turn to John chapter 2, Jesus turns water into wine, and the host of the event, or the guy overseeing the wedding feast, identifies this that wine that Jesus has made as the kind of wine that is normally considered high quality and is normally brought out at the beginning of a wedding feast. And what will happen in the course of a normal wedding feast is they'll bring out this kind of wine, and then as people drink freely, they lose their taste, and then they start bringing out the cheap stuff. Well, grape juice does not cause you to lose your taste. It requires alcohol to cause you to lose your taste. And so the maitre d' has identified the kind of wine that Jesus has just made as alcoholic. Then, if we go back to the Old Testament, when Jews would pay their tithes, they would need to transport it to Jerusalem, and sometimes they need to turn it into money and buy stuff for a feast in Jerusalem. One of the things God tells them it is okay to buy is strong drink. So as part of sacred services in Jerusalem, Israelites were told you can buy and use strong drink, which obviously means alcoholic, to celebrate what God has given you.
Tim, thanks very much. Appreciate the call and the question. I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. If you hang on the line, we will do that. Sorry to those we didn't get to, but wow, what a busy day. Jimmy Akin, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
And that does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.